Well, I'm CJLO, 1690 AM in Montreal, Quebec. I'm your host, Ariel Lasoski, and this, my friends, once again, is Liberty in Exile.
I ask you to join me in helping restore the individual freedoms and initiatives this nation once knew, to make government more the servant and not the master of us all. In this free nation, we do not choose to be ruled. We elect to be governed.
In your heart, you know he's right.
Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bring you liberty, not destroy it. The evil that governments do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones, so let it be with liberty in exile. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm your host, Ariel Lasoski, reporting to you from the bustling metropolis that is Montreal, Quebec, in Gitmo Nation, Great White North, on this, the first day of October 2010. Number here at CJLO is 514-848-7471. Our website, as always, is libertyinexile.com. That is libertyinexile.com. There we have the show blog, the Twitter feed, the links, the podcast, videos, and more, and offered to you free of charge. As always, please do check out the iTunes podcast in the iTunes store. That is where most of the listenership comes in. Therefore, we do appreciate that. And as always, we are revamping the website per your suggestions. Many stories to talk about today. Our categories today that we may cover and talk about. Number one, we broke. Number two, we mad. Number three, Big Brother. Number four, war is peace. Five, let freedom ring. Six, free crack. Seven, the corrupt state. Disinfo machines and the health brave new world state. Many clips, many articles. Let us begin, however, with the New York Times. Don't we love the New York Times? Isn't this one of the greatest newspapers that we have? I have about five articles today from the New York Times. I'm going to jump into those. Let's do BBC. Why not? I think everyone is a big fan. But we have big news going on right now in Europe, and this has to do with We Broke, the financial news. Now, governments across Europe right now are basically enacting austerity measures. And for those of us who are not well inclined in the economic field, austerity basically means that governments are cutting spending, basically reducing the burdens, starting to raise taxes, doing everything they can to save money. People, of course, do not like this at all. You see, people are protesting all over Europe right now. Now, this is pretty serious. Article here from BBC News. European cities hit by anti-austerity protests. Tens of thousands of people from around Europe have marched across Brussels in a protest against spending cuts by some EU governments. Spain has held a general strike, with protesters in Barcelona clashing with police and torching a police car. Other protests against austerity measures have been held in Greece, Italy, the Irish Republic, and Latvia. Trade unions say EU workers may become the biggest victims of a financial crisis set off by bankers and traders. Listen to the language in this article. Bankers and traders only. Many governments across the 27-member bloc have imposed punishing cuts in wages, pensions, and employment to deal with spiraling debts. On Wednesday night, Portugal's minority government announced proposals to cut civil servants' pay and state spending while raising taxes in an attempt to lower the country's debt levels. In Greece and the Irish Republic, unemployment figures are at their highest in 10 years, while Spain's unemployment has doubled in just 3 years. In Britain, the government is planning to slash spending by up to 25% to some areas, while France has seen angry protests against a planned increase in the minimum retirement age. Now, these austerity measures have been in place now since the new parliaments have been voted in, especially in Britain and in places like Spain. But people are upset about this. People in Europe love the welfare state. They cling to that. And In their eyes, the entire financial crisis, as we've come to call it, the Great Recession, as I've already heard and read in some articles now, they're very upset. They blame the banksters. And all the banks. Never do they actually look at the figures, at the economic intrigues, to realize that it goes much farther than that. It's not just people at the bank playing with the money. It's people at the central banks pumping out more currency than there actually is in the world, perpetuating this huge fractional reserve system we have. Of course, the reason for all of this downfall can't be pointed to one single thing. If it was that simple, it'd all be over, wouldn't it? There have been many symptoms, multiple systems, having to do with real estate. The real estate bubble that was created and did pop subsequently. We talked to on this show, I believe, near the beginning, talking about real estate prices. How they went down, in some places, by 20% in some cities. Now, I got to say, that is a very big deal. When you have overinflated housing like that, too many houses, too many were built. Too much credit, and there's something called quantitative easing, which the Keynesian economists like to throw out and say, this is the solution, this is the way to go. Basically, loose, fluid money everywhere. That was what they've been doing basically since 1977, since the Community Reinvestment Act, and now they're continuing with that. More and more, and that's what governments say we should do. And all the grand economists that come out and say, yes, this is what we should do, put more money into the system. Bah, bah, bah. But as we can see, same things are happening. And this is the same patterns. Everything is going on. It's the same stuff. We've seen it in history since 1932. Now, for those of us who have studied history and are students of history, we understand what is going on. We've seen examples of this. They often say that Herbert Hoover just sat on the sidelines and watched the economy go when free market economics went out the window. But that's not true. If anyone has actually looked at it, looked at the history, read the books, they know that Herbert Hoover did nothing of the sort. He intervened just like Bush did, in the same way. Public works projects, bailing out banks, all the same. FDR continued the same thing, but he just happened to be a Democrat. It all comes down to politics between the parties. Now, I have another article here from The Telegraph. A lot of things that a lot of people are talking about right now are currency battles going on in the countries. All over the world, countries want basically undervalued currency. They want this because they want to be able to boost their export and do more trading across the world. That's sort of what a lot of people are trying to do, especially China. And you can see the United States is very pissed about this, even though the United States is doing exactly the same thing. There's an article from The Telegraph. Capital controls eyed as global currency wars escalate. Brazil, Mexico, Peru, Colombia, Korea, Taiwan, South Africa, Russia, and even Poland are either intervening directly in the exchange markets to prevent their currencies rising too far or examining what options they have to stem disruptive inflows. Peter Etrad Mantalo from Numero said, quantitative easing by the U.S. Federal Reserve and other central banks is incubating serious conflict. It is forcing money into emerging market funds and, to the lesser extent, equity funds. There has truly been a wall of money entering many countries, he said. So the problem is not that there's not enough money. The problem is there's too much money. It's flooded the markets. Too much. That's what these people have been telling us. And when you flood the markets like this and you keep the interest rates low, there's no incentive to save. There's no incentive to create new businesses. I worry that we are on the cusp of a competitive race to the bottom as country after country feels they need to keep up. Brazil's finance minister Guido Mantega has complained repeatedly over the past month that his country is facing a currency war as funds flood the local bond market to take advantage of yields of 11 PC, vastly higher than anything on the offer in the West. We're in the midst of an international currency war. This threatens us because it takes away our competitiveness. Advanced countries are seeking to devalue their currencies, he said, pointing the finger at America, Europe, and Japan. He is mulling moves to tax short-term debt investments. Oh, number one culprit here. Goldman Sachs said net inflows have been running at an annual rate of about $520 billion in Asia over the last 15 months and $74 billion in Latin America. Intervention to stop it creates all kinds of problems, so the next step may be direct capital controls, the bank warned. So as we see, countries all over the world trying to devalue their currencies. How do they do this? Inflation. They print more money. That devalues your own currency. hey, in the United States, we're on the right path. Canada's doing okay. But the more that people devalue their currency, the more they hope to trade with the world. That's going to solve everything, isn't it? Why don't these people, these central bankers, understand that they are part of the problem, not the solution? This quantitative easing has been going on since the 1980s, and what has it done? Any good? Monumentous prosperity, they say. For a few years, at most. Now, this shouldn't be too complicated for all. Hope it's not too complicated for you. There are different things that have come about because of this. It's very interesting to me. It should be interesting to you as well. Now, I've been covering economics for a while here in the Bitter Exile. I believe it's very important because no new answers are being put out. It's the same people who cause the same problems offering the same solutions every time. It's unsustainable. It shouldn't work. It doesn't work. And the more that this happens, the more that people like us, the normal people, everyday people, shall suffer. Our prices shall rise. Our savings are taken away. Our taxes are raised. That's the way it goes. Isn't it beautiful? Another article I have here has to do with an article in the Globe and Mail having to do with debt. Debt, 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 debt. We're all slaves to debt. Shut up, slave. You are a debt. So basically, we have the Bank of Canada Governor Mark Carney, who's warning Canadians to curb their enthusiasm for debt. That's the title of the article. Here we are. Using particularly strong language, Mr. Carney said in a midday speech that the ratio of household debt to disposable income hit 146% in the first quarter of the year, a record and a level that is closing in on that of the United States. This cannot continue, the Central Bank chief warned, adding that while the net worth of Canadians is about six times the level of average disposable income, asset prices rise and fall, but debt endures. And despite the buoyancy of the real estate market, the debt-to-asset ratio among Canadian households is at its highest in more than two decades. With Canadians working, but not as much as they would like, they have been borrowing. But here it is. More and more in debt we go. Financial resources are not there. We are in recession. People are clamoring for resources. That's all it is. All right, this is the Isle of Soski, the Reading Exile. We'll be right back after a few promos. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Liberty in Exile. I'm Yael Osowski. Let us see here. Stories and stories and stories and stories upon stories. But I believe the most important one right now, and the most interesting, of course, has to do with the internet, wiretaps, and your government. Doesn't that make you feel great? This is coming from Associated Press. Check this out.
It is a growing problem for the government. As phone and email technologies get more sophisticated, more conversations and emails are scrambled, making it harder to use wiretaps to listen in on potentially criminal and terrorist activity. U.S. officials say law enforcement needs a better way to tap in.
As technology changes, as the internet changes, they have to keep up or they'll lose an important tool in their arsenal.
The Obama administration is proposing new regulations that would allow a wiretap to capture an unscrambled version of conversations over the phone, computer, or email, and make them readily available to law enforcement. The changes would affect social networking sites like Facebook and phone systems that deliver encrypted mail like BlackBerry. Privacy advocates say the government's reaching too far.
I mean, obviously national security is very important, but this is just an unnecessary push for greater invasion of privacy.
The FBI says the new rules would not expand any existing authority and would involve legally authorized intercepts of communications from terrorists or other criminals. Sagar Meghani, The Associated Press, Washington.
So this is basically the same government that has been telling you many things. Whenever they try to pass a healthcare bill that would change the entire relationship between you and your doctor and the entire health system. What did they tell you?
But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
We have to pass the bill so you can find out what's in it. You're going to have to know. We'll have to pass it, then you'll find out. That's amazing. So what does this story mean? This is from the New York Times. This is one of the biggest stories of the week. U.S. tries to make it easier to wiretap the internet. Federal law enforcement and national security officials are preparing to seek sweeping new regulations for the internet, arguing that their ability to wiretap criminal and terrorism suspects is going dark as people increasingly communicate online instead of by telephone. Essentially, officials want Congress to require all services that enable communications, including encrypted email transmitters like BlackBerry, social networking websites like Facebook, and software that allows direct peer-to-peer messaging like Skype, to be technically capable of complying if served with a wiretap order. The mandate would include being able to intercept and unscramble encrypted messages. The bill, which the Obama administration plans to submit to lawmakers next year, raises fresh questions about how to balance security needs with protecting privacy and fostering innovation. And because the security services around the world face the same problem, it could set an example that is copied globally.
And Congressional Quarterly CQ reports a pair of Senate committees have compromised on what could become the nation's first comprehensive law addressing cybersecurity, but it probably won't pass this year. And as I understand it, John, the New York Times is also reporting today that the administration would like to wiretap encrypted communications, peer-to-peer file sharing, that kind of thing. It's fascinating, but you have to wonder whether people even understand what it is.
It is fascinating. I was emailing with a couple of people in the administration after that New York Times story. You know, you have one of these.
Oh, I was emailing with people in the administration. If this guy is not a propaganda machine, I don't know what is. John King, CNN.
He's right. I have one of these. You can send BlackBerry messengers or pin messages on this, or maybe you Skype at home. Maybe you peer-to-peer message with your friends on Facebook.
Okay, peer-to-peer message with your friends. These people obviously don't understand or know anything about the internet. Peer-to-peer is not Skype or Facebook chat. These people are idiots.
Let me walk over the magic wall. I'll show you what this debate is about. What the administration says it wants is power to wiretap, to get wiretap power in case terrorists or drug dealers or some other...
Terrorists or drug dealers. Therefore, we must compromise the entire internet because we know there are drug dealers and there are terrorists out there.
Criminals could be using this technology because so many people now communicate on the internet, not on the old-fashioned way, on the telephone, or not even in a cell phone conversation. So what they want to do is be able to look at what you're doing on here.
They want to be able to see what you're doing on there. Hey, what are you looking at? What site are you on? What video do you like on YouTube?
Let's take a closer look at how this would work. Essentially, I could send, you know, I send my wife sometime a message. What time would we meet for dinner?
I love the music in the background.
This is what happens. It gets encrypted as it goes out, and then it comes in to the receiving device, and it gets decoded. Well, what the government wants is the ability to get this key, the encryption key, so that it can keep track of the bad guys with a warrant. Now,
we want the bad guys. We want them.
What it says is, you know, the government wants to be able to unscramble those encrypted messages, intercept messages sent from non-U.S. providers to people here in the United States. You can imagine terrorists or drug dealers having conversations like that. And
terrorists or drug dealers. Therefore, we must compromise the entire system for just these two groups of people who, how many of them are there in the world? At most, 5,000, 6,000? Oh, no, we have to compromise the entire system for billions of people across the world. Is this a joke? Is anyone paying attention? Does anyone see what's going on here? Has anyone read dystopian novels? Has anyone seen what's coming in the future? This is happening again and again. You know, we've been covering this for a while, and people just need to see with the Patriot Act, with all these wiretaps going on, telephone, email, library records, hospital records, everything of the like, everything is being seen and filed, categorized. You're just a number slave. That's all you are.
To intercept those peer-to-peer messages, again, that are encrypted now, and the government can't just go through a traditional wiretap. What are the concerns about this? Well, it could be very expensive for the technology.
Yes, John, tell us about the concerns, please.
Firms to set up that gateway, the portal, for the government to get the information. Some are worried giving the government this new power could slow and impede innovation.
Oh, it'll slow down innovation.
Using these technological devices and internet communications and... here's another big concern. It could be exploited by others, hackers and spies. Once you open a portal to get the encrypted communications, that could be a problem as well. So it is a huge debate about privacy. The administration says it's a huge law enforcement debate as well. Who's right? Who's wrong? Do you want the government to have this power when we come back?
No!
Joe, we're going to have a great debate. We've got the general counsel of the ACLU.
Okay, shut up. Yeah, so basically that's it. And who do they bring on next? Of course, they bring on Francis Townsend, who is the National Homeland Security correspondent for CNN, who also worked in the actual Homeland Security Department for President Bush. And actually, every time she does an interview, they have to say that she actually does work for them presently. She she consults with the government. So, propaganda minister on TV telling you what to think, telling you to accept it, slave, shoving it down your throat. You must accept, must accept, must accept. Now, to those of us who are awake, we see this every day. We decry it. We see this and we say, no way. Nah, we will not be bonded by this. And if enough people do actually show concern, this can be changed. But for now, I'm just me and you're just you. We're in our own corners and we're just bystanders. But this is encroaching a little farther than I believe some of us would want. The internet is the freest domain that we have seen pop up in the last 50 years. They don't like that. They don't like that at all. New York Times covered it right there on the front page. U.S. tries to make it easier to wiretap the internet. That's what they've been trying to do forever. And here it comes. Now, free expression as we know it exists more and more online. Of course, they say there's these extremist websites that are all over the place. What happens whenever people have another opinion, whenever people like to gather, have an opinion, form a group, and they put those out together? I'll tell you exactly what's happened. The FBI is confirming this morning that they began a series of raids against the homes of anti-war activists, claiming they are seeking evidence relating to activities concerning the material support of terrorism. So far, there does not appear to be any arrest related to the raids, according to FBI spokesman Steve Warfield. However, some are expected. He also said that there was no imminent threat related to the anti-war organization targeted. Some of the activists said they were ordered to appear before a grand jury, however. Here's a specific case that we have. I believe it was in Minneapolis. About 150 people are gathered outside the FBI office in Minneapolis to protest searches conducted at the homes of several anti-war activists. Protesters held signs Monday reading, "Stop FBI Enforcement. Opposing war is not a crime." They also chanted slogans like, "From Colombia to Palestine, solidarity is not a crime." Search warrants indicated investigators were looking for connections between the anti-war activists and radical groups in Colombia and the Middle East. Among those was a leader of the Minnesota Anti-War Committee, Jess Sundin. She told the crowd at least 13 people have been subpoenaed to appear before the federal grand jury in Chicago as part of the investigation. So here we are. This is it. It has come. Anti-war activists, you are terrorists. So now, from the MIAC report, we have anti-war activists, we have libertarians, conservatives, anyone who has any dissent towards the government, you're all terrorists, and basically the state is out to get you. That's what we're being told, and what is being read here in the newspapers. That's the way the story goes. Dissent, dissent, dissent. This is CJLO, 1690 AM, Montreal, Quebec. I'm your host, Eli Lasoski of Liberty in Exile. Check out our website, libertyinexile.com. Many stories that I posted this week. I don't know why. I guess I was rather inspired. Let's see. Number one that I posted has to do with something that I find very interesting. It has to do between cell phones and brain tumors. It's the link between them. Now, I've tried to bring this up a few times on the Health Brave New World State segment of the program, but I figured I might as well play it now. There was a very interesting piece that played on CBC not long ago.
Look familiar? More and more Canadians spend a lot of time with a cell phone seemingly glued to their heads. But how safe is that? In a moment, I'll be talking with a scientist about the link between our phone use and our health. But first, how much do we even know about what cell phone providers recommend for users?
Now, in this report, they basically go and they talk to people about
standards followed by...
They go and they talk to people about, you know, what do you know about your phone? Where do you have to hold your phone? Do you know about the dangers of your phone? No one has a clue. No one has a clue. Not one clue. They don't know what's going on. So basically what's going on is that in the manuals for cell phones, they actually say to hold the phones at least an inch away from your face every time you use it. Now, why is that? Why would they put that in? Let's listen to the report here.
By Industry Canada, Apple told us, iPhone's radio frequency energy is well within the limits set by Industry Canada. But are they safe if we hold them right next to our heads or wear them on our bodies? Industry Canada says that the testing standards are based on numerous scientific studies and that devices must be tested with the accessories like a holster or clip if the manufacturer provides one. Still no answer to why we're told to hold them away from our bodies. So we take a look at those standards, and it turns out they're based on some assumptions. For example, the tests use a model called SAM. That stands for Standard Anthropomorphic Man.
I know I'm not average. I know I'm kind of short for my height, but that seems kind of ridiculous.
SAM is based on the size of top military recruits.
Doesn't make any sense because the average person is not 6'2", 200 pounds.
Percentage of Canadians 6'2" or over? 2%. Percentage of Canadians 200 pounds or more? 18.1%. And there are no tests on what cell phone radiation does to kids.
17. I'm 17 tomorrow.
Ross, 17. I don't blame the company. I blame the government for not making stringent regulations upon this that they have to actually follow.
No one.
I blame the government. Oh, no. I blame the government. They haven't done enough to protect us. You have to be our nanny.
Gives us a clear answer on whether it's safe to hold it next to your body.
I'm actually going to keep my cell phone over here, and I'm not going to actually have it on my body. But yeah, it didn't make any sense to me. But yeah, I'll definitely see if I'm investing in a clip or something. Yeah.
I feel like calling my daughter now. Don't put your phones in your pocket.
So that's a great piece there from the CBC. And I did a rather long post on it on my own website, libertyinexile.com, called The Link Between Cell Phones and Brain Tumors. And what I actually did was I added a book to the Liberty in Exile book club. We have that on the website as well. Right now, I believe we're at 9 books that I do recommend to any of the audience who do wish to seek information that is not filtered through the corporate mainstream media. The new book is called Disconnect by Derva Davis, and it talks about the link between cell phones and tumors and how the science is basically, it's been warped. It's been, I guess we can say, tainted. And why is that? And she says, has to do with pressure. It has to do with industry standards. It has to do with everything else. It's science!
The science is in!
Now, what she's basically saying in this is that scientists were pressuring other scientists to come out with good results. Now, let's listen to her interview.
So those manuals are just one of the issues raised in a new book by Deborah Davis. She studies environmental effects, especially cancer risks. She's even shared a Nobel Prize with Al Gore. Her latest book reads like a conspiracy thriller, full of nasty plot lines. She accuses the cell phone industry of covering up the dangers. I met up with her in Washington and started with the cautions in those cell phone manuals. So what does that mean that this is in here?
It means that if you use the phone like that, you're not in compliance with the standards.
But why don't they put it on the phone? Who's going to read? I didn't even know this was in here.
Well, when I testified before the Senate, I called for warnings to be put on phones. Most people do not know that a cell phone is a small microwave radio. Most people do not know that microwave radiation at low doses over long periods of time has been linked to a variety of biological impacts and damage.
Microwave radio, that is what your cell phone is.
In fact, just this spring, headlines after a huge research project from the World Health Organization told us not to worry.
But what about the Interphone study? Among the Interphone team of investigators from 13 countries, some of the people aren't talking to one another. There's a big disagreement in that group.
Davis says there are two big problems with the Interphone study. There's a conflict of interest because it was partly funded by the cell phone industry, and that most of the research doesn't look at heavy users and the small part.
All right, for this, I want you to draw a parallel. I want you to think of the studies that are done on cell phones and brain tumors, the link between the two, and the study between the warming of our temperatures and human output of carbon dioxide. Just think about it.
The Dew found a doubling or even quadrupling of tumors.
So are you suggesting science is for sale? It's more subtle than that. I'm suggesting that scientists always need research money.
Scientists always need research money.
We do. And if you're getting paid very handsomely to do work, and you get to go to very nice places to present your findings.
Well, John, we are the government of Canada, and we want you to basically prove that humans are the cause of all the warming in the world, even though the planet has been warming for billions of years. We want you to go now.
There's a kind of series of subtle incentives that are operating.
But enough to not find an effect, to say, no, there's no effect?
It is more complicated than that, frankly. But sometimes you can set up a study so that it's designed to fail.
In her book, Davis says when negative effects are found, the cell phone industry goes out of its way to hide it. It's something I've heard before in stories that I've done here at CBC. In 1994, in Seattle, Henry Lai, with his study on rats, was one of the first to report that cell phone-like radiation damages DNA, seen as a first hint of cancer. When his work was reported, his funding dried up.
You freeze in 5 years, nothing happened. You wonder what's going on.
No money for you.
The head of the U.S. body that figures out how much cell phone radiation is acceptable reported a problem. When Om Gandhi...
Now, I'm going to put the... you'd have to go look at the post on the website for this part, but what they're showing right now is a picture of a human brain while it is using a cell phone, and you can see the radiation permeating throughout the brain. Now, this is stuff that they don't talk about. The parallel that I drew, and of course I'm talking about the science aspect, that has to do with climate change, or excuse me, global climate disruption, as the mainstream media has now coined it. It is now global climate disruption. It is no longer global warming. It is no longer climate change. It is global climate disruption, and it's caused only by human beings, apparently. That's what they're telling us. Now, whether your opinion on that is the same as mine, that's a different thing, but here we have my article, and I go down, and what do I do the comparison with? Big tobacco. Because in the 50s and the 60s, tobacco was smoked as heavily as water is drunk today. People did not know the harms of it until there was a piece, a journal study in Reader's Digest, which came out in the 60s, suggesting that cigarette smoking would eventually lead to certain health issues, like lung cancer. Now, people at the time threw it away. They said, this can't be, Bob, that's garbage. And actually, if any of you are fans of Mad Men and you've seen that, that was in the first season. Number one client of Sterling Cooper, Lucky Strike, comes to them and says, we need help, we need help. There's this study out that says that cigarettes may cause cancer. We got to dispel the story. We got to offer counter evidence. We got to quell the report. We have everything we need to do to make it less of an impact. And that's it. It's the same thing that's been going on between the link between cell phone use and brain tumors. Scholarly white papers have been written about this a long time. I have the Interphone study that they're mentioning in the article. I have one from the American Journal of Epidemiology, long-term mobile phone use and brain tumor risk. All scholarly white papers, and they basically prove that the longer and more that you use your cell phone, the more susceptible you will be in the future to brain tumors. Now, why does no one talk about this in the mainstream? Can't tell you. Don't know. I have articles from the Globe and Mail, City News, Toronto, Time Magazine, many others. Go on libertyinexile.com. You shall see them there. And the interesting link that I draw has to do with the movie Thank You for Smoking with Aaron Eckhart, which is based upon the book of the same name by Christopher Buckley, having to do with Big Tobacco at first. Of course, you have Nick Naylor, who is the lobbyist, works for Big Tobacco, works for them for a while, and then after a while sees the evils of tobacco, sees the health effects of tobacco, and he signs on to a new project. And what is it? It's proving, basically, that the use of cell phones and brain tumors are not connected at all. Very interesting. If you're interested in that, go to the website. Many other articles to go through, of course. How about some more science? I think we like that.
Astronomers at NASA believe that a new planet called Gliese 581G, detected outside the Earth's solar system, may have a temperature that is just right to support life. NASA scientist Doug Hudgens.
Gliese 581G has an orbit of just about 37 days around the star. And when you listen to that, you think, wow, that must be way too close to the star for there to be life, because that's a short orbit. So this is shorter than the orbit of Mercury.
That's a short orbit.
Around our own sun. Must be terribly hot.
Actually,
that's not the case, because Gliese 581, like I said, a red dwarf star, much cooler than our sun, emits much less radiation.
Scientists estimate temperatures on the planet that's 20 light years away from Earth average from minus 24 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Gliese 581G has a mass 3 to 4 times that of Earth.
Gliese 581G. There it is, folks. We found another planet in the Goldilocks zone. Goldilocks zone, meaning not too warm, not too cold, just right. Now, I think this is amazing. This is the future. This is an example of long news. This is something that has been discovered right now and will matter 100 and 200, 300 years from now. I like to cover these types of stories because these things actually matter. What your politicians say day by day, those things don't matter. They fade. Policies are changed. Ideas are changed. Salary goes up. Salary goes down. Sports teams win and lose. They're traded off. They move cities. Countries fade. Flags are burnt. Anthems are changed. Languages disperse. But finding a new planet 20 light years away that could someday support human life, it's a big deal. But of course, as we've seen, Obama and his administration has cut the NASA budget. Now, could this be the time for private industry to step in? That I'm very reluctant. Because who are the first people to line up? Well, they're people who are involved in the military-industrial complex. It's Lockheed Martin. It's companies like that want to get into space. But what do they want to do? They want to weaponize space. I mean, that's what we need to do. We need guns up there. Because if there's one thing we got to do, we got to shoot aliens. Isn't that amazing? Speaking of that, there's also been a lot of alien memes that have been going around recently. There was a couple of clips, people on Fox News and CNN talking about certain military officials who have seen UFOs, have seen sightings and things of the nature, and they've come out in this book talking about it. And the UN is thinking about actually appointing an ambassador for alien races, interestingly enough, as reported in the Telegraph. A lot of things going on like that. Very interesting to me. Very interesting to me. Now, this is very important stuff. Things could happen in the future. Who knows? Now, I will concede that our planet is getting much warmer. Our planet is becoming well-used. We as human beings do use up a lot of the planet. My only argument is that the planet has been here a long time. It shall sustain, and it shall be here much longer than human beings. We are not the first animals to walk this planet. Well, it depends on what your beliefs are, actually. there's actually an interesting article here from the New York Times having to do with religion tests in the United States. I'm going to read this here. Basic religion test stumps many Americans. Americans, by all measures, a deeply religious people, but they are also deeply ignorant about religion. Researchers from the independent Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life phoned more than 3,400 Americans and asked them 32 questions about the Bible, Christianity, and other world religions, famous religious figures, and constitutional principles governing religion and public life. On average, people who took the survey answered half of the questions incorrectly, and many flubbed even questions about their own faith. Those who scored the highest were atheists and agnostics, as well as two religious minorities, Jews and Mormons. The results were the same even after the researchers controlled for factors like age and racial differences. Even after all these other factors, including education, are taken into account, atheists and agnostics, Jews and Mormons still outperform all the other religious groups in our survey, said Greg Smith. Now there's a little chart here. Average number of questions answered correctly out of 32. Atheist, agnostics 20.9, Jewish 20.5, Mormon 20.3, white evangelical Protestant 17.6, white Catholic 16, white mainline Protestant 15.8, nothing in particular 15.2, black Protestant 13.4, Hispanic Catholic 11.6. Among the topics covered in the survey were: where was Jesus born? What is Ramadan? Whose writings inspired the Protestant Reformation? Which biblical figure led the Exodus from Egypt? What religion is the Dalai Lama? Joseph Smith? Mother Teresa? In most cases, the format was multiple choice. The researcher said the questionnaire was designed to represent a breadth of knowledge about religion, but was not intended to be regarded as a list of the most essential facts about the subject. Most of the questions were easy, but a few were difficult. Difficult enough to discern which respondents are highly knowledgeable. On questions about the Bible and Christianity, the groups that answered the most right were Mormons and white evangelical Protestants. On questions about world religions like Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Judaism, the groups that did the best were atheists, agnostics, and Jews. Interesting article, of course. This is Liberty in Exile. I'm your host, Daniel Lasosky. We're right back after these mini messages.
I mean, sometimes you just ain't all there.
Listen to all our great shows on CGLO 1690 AM. Plenty of shows, actually. I was looking at the new lineup now for the fall. Quite a huge number of shows for you. If you like punk music, you like rock music, you like jazz music, got it all. But, hey, if you're into talk radio, this is the place. Now, an article from the Dallas Observer. And by the way, the New York Times article I read earlier about religion just seems very interesting to me. We're in a time where, of course, I'm in Quebec right now. We're in Montreal, which is one of the most secular societies in the world. Therefore, religion is not as important as it is in, say, my hometown, Concord, North Carolina, and other places like that. As we can see, religion is at the forefront of a lot of political debate, and it does cloud many people's minds, especially when it comes to New York mosques about burning Qurans, burning things that people have absolutely no clue about. Speaking of burning books, which I've always found interesting ever since I did read Fahrenheit 451, it has to do with a Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer. Now, this guy has been in the news a little bit, and I actually posted about him on my website at libertyinexile.com, and I make the case that he's one of the most important military voices today. And why is that? He does that because he's been a constant thorn in the side of the military. He's basically been one who's dissented with the government, who's dissented with the military. Now, this guy was one of the head intelligence officers in the program Able Danger right before 9/11, and he was one of the people who basically came out and said, yeah, we had knowledge that Mohammed Atta and some of his friends were in the United States, they were doing this and that, and the military has done everything they have to censure him, to get rid of him, basically to stop him. And what's the latest thing they do? Well, according to the New York Times, they're buying all of his books that just came out. There's a book called Operation Dark Heart that's also been added to the Liberty in Exile book club. Book to read, very interesting, called Spycraft and Special Ops on the Front Lines of Afghanistan and the Path to Victory. In this book, he basically dispels many secrets, talks about Able Danger Program, talks about how the government could have done a lot more to prevent 9/11 and the like. Government does not like this. So what does the Pentagon do? It buys 50,000 copies of his and they burn them. They obliterate them. burning books. Isn't that amazing? I've got the post here on the website, and for the listeners of the podcast, I'll actually be playing an interview that he did on Russia Today, which is basically the only news network that would have him. It is Russian state TV, but at times they do have interesting interviews. Now, health, brave new world state. I talked about health last time. I talked about, of course, what's going on with corn sugar, as they're calling it now, which is actually high fructose corn syrup, and how they've changed the name. But now there's an article coming from the Dallas Observer talking about how alcohol consumption is on the rise just because of the recession. Here's one for the multitudes. We'll be struggling not to nap the afternoon away after a 3-martini lunch. According to research conducted by UT Southwestern Medical Center, boozing is on the rise. What appears to have been a decline in drinking that began in the mid-80s through the 90s has officially tanked, as it were. People today drink more than they did 20 years ago across both sexes and 3 identified ethnic groups. An article in R&D Mag quotes Dr. Raul Castro, dean of the UTSW School of Health Professions, who speculates that changes in the population due to aging, the influx of immigrant groups, and the decline in mean income level because of economic recessions could all be causes for the increase. Wow. So basically, as a people now, as a populace, we are drinking much more than we used to. Very interesting to me. Interesting that articles come out like this. Now, could this be part of the neo-prohibitionist movement? Could be. We've seen a lot of memes come about because of that, people who want to ban drinking. In Pennsylvania right now, if you want to buy wine, you have to take a breathalyzer test at the grocery store. You're not allowed to buy any wine if your alcohol, blood alcohol concentration is any more than 0.0000000. There we are. That's controlling the populace. And it's interesting enough that most of the states own the liquor stores. They own them. It's the government that puts out this liquor, that puts out the alcohol. They're making profits off of you getting skunked. Isn't that amazing? That's the way it works. Now, there's a interesting ruling that was handed down here in Canada. It was in Ontario, and it's actually made strides across North America. Very interesting to me. Prostitution law struck down by Ontario court. An Ontario court has thrown out key provisions of Canada's anti-prostitution laws in response to a constitutional challenge by a Toronto dominatrix and 2 prostitutes in 2009. Well, that had to be an amazing court right there. I object! Ontario's Superior Court of Justice ruled Tuesday that the criminal code provisions relating to prostitution contribute to the danger faced by sex trade workers. Really? You're telling me that a law against something is actually hurting people? No way. In her ruling, Justice Susan Himmel said it now falls to Parliament to fashion corrective action. It is my view that in the meantime, these unconstitutional provisions should be of no force and effect, particularly given the seriousness of the charter violations, Himmel wrote. However, I also recognize that a consequence of this decision may be that unlicensed brothels may be operated, and in a way that may not be in the public interest. The judge suspended the effect of the decision for 30 days. It does not affect provisions dealing with people under 18. Federal Justice Minister Rob Nicholson and Rana Ambrose, Minister for the Status of Women. Minister for the Status of Women. Interesting post. Both said the government is concerned about the decision and is seriously considering an appeal. Dominatrix Terry Jean Bedford, Valerie Scott, and Amy Leibovich have argued that prohibitions on keeping a common body house, communicating for the purposes of prostitution, and living on the avails of the trade force them from the safety of their homes to face violence on the streets. The woman asked the court to declare legal restrictions on their activities a violation of charter rights of security of the person and freedom of expression. Now, this is making waves across North America, as I said, and right now in Ontario and if we follow this ruling right now in Quebec and elsewhere, prostitution is somewhat legal. Of course, the conservative government has come out against it, and they're saying, oh, we're going to create a law. We're going to come out against it. But as we can see, the courts have their balance of power. Courts have ruled. Now, as an advocate of free markets and one of liberty in this instance, I see this as a gain for our category. Too soon and too often we've seen many women killed, murdered, strangled, anything of the like because they've been forced onto the streets. And where you have something that is illegal, just like the drug war that we talk about, when you have something illegal, That means if the government sees you doing it, you're going to go to prison. You'll get a fine. If there's something that is illegal, they have to keep it discreet. They have to keep it underneath the common view, because otherwise they'll go to jail, and that's risky. So you are more likely to engage in risky behavior, like in the drug war, buying guns, shooting people, killing, and now, this is something that I've covered on Liberty in Exile for a while. Something that I believe is quite important. We shall continue to see how these issues affect us each and every day. We do live in our own bubbles, but we do share a society collectively, whether or not we are forced to. We do come together during private enterprise, private exchanges. We come together and we do agree upon collective rights. We do agree upon individual rights. That is the nature of people coming together. I've given you all the information here today on Liberty in Exile for you to lead a more poignant life, one in which you are better informed about what is going on around you. When you cannot pay attention, when you must go through the dealings of life, when you must raise a family, you must go to work 9 to 5, we are here to give you the information that does not filter through the corporate media, that is caught in the traps, that does not get picked up nor emphasized in the correct fashion. That is what I hope to do on this show. That is what we shall continue to do as Liberty in Exile continues. This is Liberty in Exile. I'm your host, Dalia Losowski. Go to our website, libertyinexile.com. Download the podcast, see the blogs, the videos, Twitter feed, and the like. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, we can go to a story, but the Department of Defense thinks it's better suited for a paper shredder. We're talking about a book that was released in a first print, then completely bought by the military, marked up with a magic marker, and sent back out with the Department of Defense seal of approval. We're talking about a book called Dark Heart, Spycraft, and Special Ops on the Front Lines of Afghanistan. That's a long title. And joining us now is its author and former Army Intel Officer, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you here,
thank you, first of all. Good to be here.
So what happened? That's just a very basic question. What happened here?
Well, I think it's a fascinating backstory by the fact that we actually worked with the Army, the organization I do belong to as a reservist, to work to vet the book. Vetting being going through and being very careful to not reveal anything in the way of secrets which would detrimentally affect our troops, our operations, or our allies within the region. That process took about 8 months. The book's been in works for 2 years. And that process was collaborative. Things were taken out. They were completely taken out. Army asked, I did. And that process ended January of this year. At that point in time, through my lawyer, Mark Zaid, the manuscript was passed to the publisher, St. Martin's Books, Thomas Dunn Books, who did the book. And the funny thing is that all through this entire time, between January and today, there was total public awareness of the book. I actually, when Joe McChrystal got fired, I was on Larry King Live and Bill O'Reilly, two of the most prominent national programs, talking about the fact that my book's coming out. It's going to talk about some of the issues. That
it really was no surprise.
No surprise. I mean, I don't know. Maybe, unless I would have gone in with a blowhorn and stood in front of the Pentagon and yelled about my book, I don't know how else I could have made it any more clear that the book was coming out.
Sure.
So with that said, late in the summer, when the book was ready to be released, you know, three guys in black suits and sunglasses shows up at the publisher and basically says, hey, we've got a lot of problems with this book, and if you publish it, the free world's going to fall. So the publisher had to take notice. I mean, anytime guys show up from Washington, you got to do something.
Sure.
And this is where the current backstory starts regarding the book. I mean, last time I was here with you, we talked a little bit about it. Again, no secret is coming, but the whole issue became what DOD did and did not like in the book. And obviously, we've worked on that issue for the past month. It resulted in the book you see today, Operation Darkheart, second edition, which is on the newsstand. Sure. So that's kind of the backstory of how we got to where we're at right now.
Okay, well, so, I mean, if they had been given ample warning and you had made the circuit on TV all over the place, radio, print also,
right,
then the question becomes, what gives?
And to answer your question, this is one of those things that sources are telling me what's going on. I don't think any DOD official is going to comment on this officially, but two major events happened which changed the atmosphere regarding my book.
Sure.
First, WikiLeaks. When the WikiLeaks issues hit the table, there was about, several tens of thousands of documents, and it was very nebulous. It was like, this means something, but no one could really make out what it really means. It was all this stuff just kind of thrown out there. And within the context of that, some little nuggets here and there, and it went ostensibly from 2004 forward, confirming a lot of the things that have been in the press already relating to the ISI, a lot of bad news. And second thing that happened is Joe McChrystal's firing. I was publicly commented, I was in favor of President Obama retaining him for any number of reasons. He's in my book. I talk about working for him in 03. And those two events changed the very fabric of the Pentagon and their concerns.
And their attitude towards you.
And their attitude towards me. Because all of a sudden, there's a lot of information to back up what I'm saying. They can't just say, I'm a disgruntled employee, nothing to see here. All of a sudden, you've got people saying, hey, you made me take a look at this. And the book actually predates the information that's already out there. Not new, but predates information relating to the ISI factually not supporting the effort, according to what we would believe that we'd like him to do as an ally. Mm-hmm. Factually indicates the Iranians were already involved in doing mischief, is the best way of putting it, as early as 2003. I have an two chapters are dedicated to an interrogation I do with the FBI and part of Afghanistan. I cannot say they took that out of the book, which is fine. And then the last issue obviously has to do with the Taliban, which is the central feature of the current strategy. And this is, I think, one of the things people are most concerned about, and the tipping point. The book really factually focuses on the tipping point. It's a good read. It is actually an action-adventure. Mm-hmm. I wrote it like from the perspective of the Martin Sheen character in Apocalypse Now, to see it and to experience it.
Right.
I didn't run into a madman, with water over his head, but close. But the idea was here is that I wanted people to feel it. So we talk in great deal about the Taliban and the fact that we recognized in 03 their recreation of themselves in Pakistan in three primary safe havens. And Operation Darkheart is the operation that I put together with others to go into those safe havens to destabilize their effort to resurge, to buy the Afghan people and government more time. So that's the focus of the book.
Right, but let's go back and let's go to what the Department of Defense said about the first print, which was, look, if you release the information that's in this book right now as it is, you're going to, and I think you said something to the effect of, shake the world or shake the foundations of the world or whatever. You're going to say that wasn't necessarily the case, and this might be just a simple case of retribution from the part of the Department of Defense.
Well, you got to look at the people involved here. And I think the classification very much is in the eye of the beholder. It's very subjective.
Of course.
The New York Times article talked about how subjective a lot of this is. And frankly, I don't want to mention a competitor's book, which came out today, but if you read his book, something about President Obama's war, you'll see no-nonsense classified information in there. And it's amazing it's like, and you don't see people screaming about that. So you got to wonder. Defense Intelligence Agency took a strong role in this. Every document which came to the Army came from Defense Intelligence Agency, not from the overall manager of the intelligence community, which is the Undersecretary of Defense of Intelligence for the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. So you got to wonder, okay, that's the first indicator. And then over this past weekend, I was in the press, did a CNN interview, and the only people that CNN could get to comment on it was Defense Intelligence Agency.
Right.
So there's a pattern emergency. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you and I have talked about this a little bit. I was a whistleblower in something called Able Danger back in 2005. Actually, my first disclosure of that came in 2003 at Bagram Air Force Base while they're on assignment undercover. And this is the central issue. I reported to the proper chain of command, which is an Army chain of command, the fact that I knew pre-9/11 intelligence. I was given permission by an Army chain of command to go talk to the 9/11 Commission. Defense Intelligence Agency took great exception by the fact that they were not given the ability to say yay or nay to my testimony, my disclosure at that point. Then again, fast forward to 2005. This was 2003, 2005. I'm called to Capitol Hill. Speaker of the House, Denny Hastert, the number three guy in the American government, says, "We need you to help us investigate Able Danger." Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? I mean, the number three guy in government, you know. So I chose the path of supporting Congress and doing their investigation. And again, over that support to Congress and their testimony, my security clearance was permanently revoked by Defense Intelligence Agency. So all these years later, I do a book detailing this, and all of a sudden, they're all hot and bothered when, you know, after other folks have looked at the book, frankly, part of the clearance process, I offered up the Army's work. They didn't want to look at it. So you got to wonder why, you know, why would you not want to go through and check the Army's work to make sure that they did do due diligence finding sourcing that was adequate? And their answer was, well, you're more credible than others, so we, you know, we, so that was their excuse. Now, I appreciate the credibility and I appreciate the free advertising, sure. But you know, I'm not quite sure if they're, you know, on the up and
sure.
up.
Sure. So the DIA specifically under the Department of Defense really had it in for you. There was one thing I wanted to ask you about, and I know we don't have too much time here,
yeah.
But there was something I read about from all reports. I've been saying something about, you knew something about Mohammed Atta. Can you
right.
clarify that for us?
Well, and that was the Able Danger disclosure. Able right. Danger was a pre-9/11 Special Operations Command mission, which was designed to conduct offensive operations against al-Qaeda. And again, the significance here is pre-9/11.
Right, before 9/11.
And the idea was we used something at the time was totally exotic, now common, called data mining. Data mining has become a part of our lexicon, a part of daily life. Amazon, all the big people who sell stuff use data mining. At the time, it was brand new, as the Internet was much younger than 10 years ago. And what we did is we took and digitized profiles of individuals who are known terrorists. In this case, the 93 World Trade Center bombers. We took profiles and turned them into digitized them, and then built an algorithm to say, anyone who fits this profile, go find them in
right.
this larger Internet. And that
right.
was the crux of what happened. Within that data run, we found four of the 9/11 terrorists, to include Mohammed Atta. I made that disclosure to Philip Zelikow, Dr. Philip Zelikow, at Bagram in October of 2003. Which started the odyssey for me, leaving the intelligence business and doing what I do now. So.
Right, which is why the DIA wasn't exactly happy with you. The fact that you already knew about Mohammed Atta, you said people already knew about Mohammed Atta, we did nothing about it. We just kind of, I mean, they just sat out
yes.
of their hands.
And this was in my open testimony, yes.
Okay. Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, thank you so much for joining us
thank
and telling
you.
Us about your exploits.
Thank you for having me.